get over to the House for another presentation. And I understand that to be the case. Where's the committee administrator, Chelsea? We've decided to go ahead with that presentation immediately so that they can do their work and get over to the House in a timely way. So with that, Commissioner Tinkerthal is here to talk about an overview of the agency and an update on the Heading Home business plan.
Thank you, Senator Sharon, and welcome back to all members. We look forward to working with the committee over the next year. We have distributed a brief PowerPoint presentation as well as a couple of one-page handouts, and we'll go through them very quickly. The purpose today is to really give you an overview of the agency, what we do, give you a chance for some questions. So I'll start on page 2 with our mission. It's pretty simple. We finance affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities.
Would you mind saying your name for the record?
Yes, Mary Tinkerthal, Commissioner at Minnesota Housing. On page 3, we have just what we're going to talk about in the next few minutes, that we're the state's mission-driven financial institution for housing. We're going to go over our mission and strategic priorities, our program financing, how we do it, our program delivery, how the dollars actually get to homeowners and building owners, a program overview of how our programs fit together, and finally, the impact of our housing investments. On page 4, we wanted to show you something that really hit home with a lot of other commissioners when we were preparing our budget this year. What we've shown you is just a very quick example of the really positive impact that affordable housing can have on a low-income family. At the top, you see that the income of the family we're talking about here is $22,000, which is the federal poverty threshold. That's what a family of four makes and is considered at the poverty threshold in Minnesota. And
real quick, that's slide 4. I see a couple of people going to page 4.
Oh,
we have two
slides
per page.
Slide
4.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
There are almost 675,000 households that spend more than 30% of their income on housing. So that's 33% of the households in Minnesota. So if you wondered, you know, our housing programs through Minnesota Housing focused on a really narrow group of people, the answer is absolutely not. So what we've shown here is on the left side, market rate housing in the Twin Cities might be at about $927 a month. In fact, that's a pretty good deal these days for a two-bedroom apartment. And what you see on the left-hand side is that by the time the family gets done paying rent, utilities, transportation, food, and health care, they're already in a negative position if they do not have any assistance with housing. On the right side, we show the impact of being able to have an affordable unit so that if this same family was living in a project that has federal Section 8 rental subsidies, they would be in a much better position because instead of $927 a month, they would be paying $550 a month for that same apartment. So just something to carry with you as to what the impact is when we are able to provide affordable rental housing. On slide number 5, I'll quickly go through our strategic priorities. We did just redevelop a strategic plan with a lot of input from across the community, and there are 5 priorities within that plan. The first, and probably the longest thing that the Housing Finance Agency has done, is promoting and supporting successful home ownership. We hope to serve close to 3,000 families in the next year, most of them first-time home buyers, with help in being able to buy their very first home. Secondly, the preservation of federally subsidized rental housing. This is housing where we receive millions of dollars each year in federal rental subsidies that are actually attached to the specific buildings. And what our goals in this area are is to make sure that those buildings stay in the program so that we can continue to provide those rental subsidies. Because if the building and the building owner leave the program, that subsidy from the federal government is gone forever. It's not replaced into another building. The third is to address specific and critical needs in rental housing markets around the state. We held a series of regional dialogues last year and learned that the need for rental housing is very, very different from one part of the state to another. And we've been making some changes to our allocation plans so that we can reflect those differences in a way that's helpful to each region. Fourth is to prevent and end homelessness, and fifth is to prevent foreclosures and support recovery of communities after the foreclosure crisis. On slide number six, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the structure of the agency. We are a very unusual agency. We have an appointed board of directors that meets monthly. It is comprised of six citizens that are appointed by the governor, three from the metro area, three from greater Minnesota, and the state auditor serves as an ex officio member. The agency has been around for 41 years and managed under this structure. All of our statutory directives are largely included in a single portion of the statute, and it is in that statute that management and control of the agency is vested in the board of directors. The board of directors then has the authority to delegate the administrative control of the agency to the commissioner. The commissioner, myself, I am also appointed by the governor, not by the board. And the terms of the board members are staggered terms, and they are not coterminous with the governor. So it's very much a rotating and very historically very nonpartisan entity.
Commissioner, at this point, would you delineate a little more clearly for us as legislators? What you're talking about here right now is that this board really functions maybe very similar to the Minsku board or the Regents board in terms of its authority over this, the policies of this agency. And so how then does the legislature interface with the board? Around what kinds of subjects would this committee interface?
Thank you, Senator Sharon. The manner in which the agency has operated is that the statute of the agency is in Section 462A, and in that section are various powers that are granted to the agency. So there are very broad general powers. Within those powers, then the board of directors is empowered to implement programs that are in compliance and in concert with that general statutory language. Also, the board has within those powers, for example, the authority to issue debt. Many of the dollars that we utilize, particularly for our single-family lending program, are raised by selling bonds in the capital markets. So we have our own capital markets staff. We work very closely with Minnesota Management and Budget, but we do have the authority to issue bonds through the authority of the board. So again, it's a statutory, sets out the major parameters, and then those statutory directives are then implemented by the board of directors and their votes. Any appropriations that come into the agency are allocated to programs that are really designed by the statutory language. It is relatively infrequent that we come to the legislature to have our statute amended. The powers are fairly broad within the statute and allow us to utilize dollars with some flexibility within those statutory sections.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that's actually a great segue to slide number 7. The way that we articulate to the legislature and to really the citizens of the state of Minnesota how those resources will be utilized is done on an annual basis through a public document called our Affordable Housing Plan. You can really think of this as the programmatic business plan of the agency. It is adopted in a public process through our board of directors. We typically begin to discuss it in August of each year and then adopt it in September. And what you see here is just a breakdown of the sources of dollars that we have available in the current Affordable Housing Plan, which began on October 1st of 2012. The largest category, as I alluded to, is tax-exempt bond proceeds at 56%, federal funds at 25%. A lot of that is the management of rental assistance from the federal government. Agency resources make up 10%, and that is if we make more money on our lending than we need to run the agency, we actually have an automatic process for plowing those dollars back into programs. And then the smallest proportion is made up through state appropriations, which will be coming before the Finance Committee for the agency for this year. Our operating budget is also very different from other agencies. Operating budget is not funded by state appropriations, and that means that 100% of state appropriations go into programs. So they go directly into loans for home buyers or loans for property owners or assistance for homeless families. Our operating costs are about $25.5 million. We have about 220 employees, and our operating costs are 3.2% of all the assistance that we provide. That's a number that we are obligated to provide to the legislature each year, and you can track that performance over time, which has been in a similar level. Our primary revenue source, how we pay for all this, is through a spread on our lending. So we are able to issue bonds and then lend those dollars out at a slightly higher rate. And probably the biggest component of our employees are really dedicated to the management of our long-term portfolios. We have about a $3.5 billion balance sheet, so we have a lot of loans that have been made over the last 40 years, and it really is much like a bank. Once you've built up a portfolio, you have to spend a certain amount of time and opportunity making sure that that portfolio continues to perform well. On slide number 9, program delivery is done in a very dispersed basis. Almost all of the assistance that we provide is through a network of private delivery partners. That includes lenders. So our single-family loan program, if you're a borrower in Minnesota that qualifies for one of our mortgage programs, you do not make an application to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. You make an application to your local community bank. That bank then processes the application, packages it, underwrites it, and then sells that loan to the Housing Finance Agency. So we operate essentially as a secondary market. But what that means is that the program is administered at a level very close to the citizens of Minnesota. It isn't a bureaucratic program, and they get to deal with their local community lender. In our multifamily area, the properties that we finance are developed by private developers, both for-profit and nonprofit. And those developers also typically manage the properties. So again, it's business people, it's nonprofits that you may well be familiar with in your community that are the owners and managers of these properties. So it's not the Housing Finance Agency that your community sees on the street. It really is private developers and managers. And finally, for our homeless programs, social service providers, that we work very closely with the Department of Human Services to ensure that those dollars are using existing channels, so we're not duplicating efforts in terms of getting the dollars to the people that need them. And programs are accessed through a variety of delivery methods. For some of our bigger dollar amounts, we have an annual request for proposals where we typically get three or four times as many proposals as we have resources to allocate. Our single-family program is more on a first-come, first-served basis where people can just go to their local community bank in order to apply for those resources. On slide number 10, we often are asked about the distribution of assistance. We do not have a strict allocation plan by region of the state, but we are always very attentive and report each year to the community about how we've done in terms of distribution of resources. I won't go over this in detail, but to just give you an idea what the red and the blue are, is the red really shows the percentage of lower income cost burdened households. That's households paying more than 30% of their income for housing costs. And then we show on the left in the blue the amount of the assistance that in the last year went into those areas. So that'll fluctuate a lot from year to year, where one year there might be a big project out in Detroit Lakes, and it'll make that blue segment of the West Central pie be a little bit bigger. The next year, that project might be up in Thief River Falls. So they fluctuate a bit from year to year. Just some highlights in terms of the big picture. How many people do we impact on slide number 11? In 2012, that's our program year 2012, which ended September of last year, we served 63,000 households with about $638 million going into housing. To give you an idea of targeting, 78% of the renters that live in buildings receiving assistance through the agency have incomes under $20,000 per year, and 54% of the home buyers assisted had an annual income under $45,000. And more than 2,300 first-time home buyers were assisted, and I think importantly that 23% of those were households of color. We have a very creative and focused program where we work with both realtors and lenders to really make sure that these state resources and federal resources are reaching households of color. On number 12, we are beginning to look now at our five strategic priorities, the first of which is promoting successful home ownership. This is done through bond-financed first mortgages for first-time home buyers, typically at or below market interest rates. They're originated by lending institutions, as I mentioned. The median income is just under $45,000. Deferred loans are provided to some of these borrowers that provides them help with down payment and closing cost assistance. Amazingly to me, this is one of the oldest programs that has been funded by the legislature continuously since shortly after the agency was established, and really has been a hallmark for the state in helping low and moderate income homeowners really achieve that dream of home ownership without getting them in trouble with a adjustable rate mortgage. Home improvement and rehabilitation loans, also a very, very important part of our programs, because we have so much older housing stock in Minnesota and such a high percentage of home ownership, these are programs that allow low-income families that are already homeowners, and this often can be elderly families, to really keep up to date on improvements to their homes. And importantly, we include accessibility improvements, and we're having more conversations with the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services in how we can make sure that when someone is able to stay in their home, but for needing some accessibility assistance, that we're making those linkages so that they can get access to these funds.
Commissioner, would you be open to a question at this time?
Absolutely.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I was interested in the the home improvement and the home rehabilitation loans. And what's the connection or how do those work with the home path loans? Or is that are from the feds, you know, some of the home path loans and home path mortgages and the home path renovation rehabilitation loans? I'm just wondering if there, what that connection is.
Senator Nelson, I have to confess I'm not familiar with the term PATH, home PATH.
Oh, well, you can find it on the, I guess you can find it on the web, but it's where the, it's through, I thought it was through the federal government in helping get foreclosures off the market and providing lower interest rate loans to those particular I think it's more tied to the property than it is to the income of the individual. But I was just wondering what type of coordination there is, and maybe we can talk about that after you have a chance to look at that.
Right. We certainly can get back to you on that. We do always try to coordinate funding sources. For example, a lot of community action agencies receive weatherization dollars, and for very, very low-income families, oftentimes the weatherization dollars are used to do the energy efficiency improvements, and maybe one of our rehabilitation loans might be used to fix the roof. So we often are using the same administrators so that there's no duplication of effort, and we are trying to stretch those dollars as far as we can. One of the other things I will say is that following the 2009 stimulus package, when there were energy conservation rebates, we actually teamed up with the Department of Commerce, where it was a one-stop application for borrowers who took out a loan under our home improvement loan program to also get the energy rebate. So again, stretching those dollars as far as possible and coordinating the programs. But we'll check into the Home Path program
Thank
and get
you.
Back to you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Chair. Thank you. Continue, please.
Yes, on page 13, finishing up our discussion about homeownership. You'll see when you see the budget document that there are a number of performance measures that we hold ourselves accountable for, and this is just giving you a preview of some of what those things will be with each of these five strategic priorities. 30% of down payment assistance is our goal for providing to emerging markets or households of color. We aim to provide close to or a little more than a third of our rehabilitation loans, which is our lowest income home improvement product, to provide it to seniors, again, with coordination with health and human services so that we can do some of those accessibility or health-related improvements, and that we maintain our foreclosure rate consistently below the industry benchmark, which is something that we were successful in doing throughout the foreclosure crisis. Moving on to page 14, we move into our second priority, which is preserving federally subsidized rental housing. How do we do that? I mentioned that these are existing buildings that if they're lost to the inventory because an owner will take it to market rate, those rental subsidies would be lost to the state forever. The way we do this is we work with building owners to make improvements to the properties using amortizing and deferred loans. And we also provide some of these with homeowners as well, although generally we're not doing federally subsidized housing there. Incentives are often in the form of financial assistance to improve the properties, preserve them, those that have rental subsidies. The state appropriated program, once you begin to see the budget, is called PARIF, Preservation of Affordable Rental Improvement Fund. And just to give you an idea of what we do with these dollars, we come close to leveraging $5 in federal assistance for every $1 of state assistance that is spent in this type of activity. Performance measures for preservation. The median income for households in these federally assisted properties is very low, under $15,000 a year. And in our last program year, we preserved 2,232 units. Moving on to our third priority, addressing needs in the rental housing markets. This program is designed to serve low and moderate income wage earners, so we're kind of moving up the income spectrum just a little bit. And the particular program that you'll see referred to in our budgets is the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program. And as people talk to you about this, they will refer to it as the Challenge Program. And that name comes from one of the characteristics of the statutory language for this program, which is that it requires us, absolutely requires us, to leverage private resources in order to access these dollars. This was something that was formulated in the late 1990s at a time when there was a shortage of workforce housing throughout the state. And in some parts of our state, we're beginning to see that shortage again, where we have employers who are saying that there just aren't enough places for their employees to live. And so we will really be looking again to state the challenge to employers to make use of these dollars to the extent that they are available. It's generally provided in the form of deferred loans, and it is housing that's developed by local units of government, for-profit, and nonprofit developers, mostly the for-profit and nonprofit developers.
Yes, sorry, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, can you just explain a little bit about the private resources? Where are they coming, the examples of who is contributing to this challenge program?
Senator Rosen, historically, although not in the last few years, but historically those dollars have come from employers in the various forms. For example, if they have chosen to develop single-family housing, they might provide it in the form of down payment assistance. Sometimes they will simply provide a deferred loan to the program, and other times they will invest in the federal housing tax credits that may be used to develop the property. So it's relatively flexible in terms of how we can fit their capabilities and their appetites for investment, but there are a number of examples of how that's been done.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Commissioner, who's they? I mean, just give me an example of who is a private resource.
Probably the biggest employer that stepped up for this kind of activity was the Mayo Clinic. Oh,
okay. Okay, thank you.
So you have a major employer in a community that has a shortage of housing, and they will work with the developers typically and the agency and often a nonprofit lender called the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund to really put together a financial package that gets them the desired results but uses the private developer market to get that done.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you so much. In my Senate district in southern Minnesota, normally we don't have housing issues of this magnitude. However, in the area that was just expanded into Jackson, they are having severe housing issues, and to the point where it's a detriment towards being able to get people to come in to work. They're increasing. This AgCam, ECHO, is increasing in size, and they need good qualified people, but the housing is an issue. So I was just wondering about how this all works together. So thank you, Madam Chair.
It's exactly what this program is designed for.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you, Commissioner.
The challenge program, among other things, allows us to use one of our biggest federal resources, which is the federal low-income housing tax credit, to serve lower-income households than that program requires. That program allows you to go up to 60% of median income. Typically, we are able, through the use of the challenge program, to target that a little bit lower, or to do mixed-income housing, because sometimes the issue we have with employers is that while they might not be paying an astronomical wage, they're paying a wage that puts people above the 60% level. So we're working with some models and developers to try to get some mix of incomes in those buildings. The Challenge Fund, I think, does a great job of leverage. We leverage about $7.50 of non-state resources for every $1 that's invested into a project from the Challenge Fund. And this is probably our most competitive resource. We get the most applications to utilize these dollars as communities are looking for projects.
Commissioner, how often, I know your time is tight here, so we probably should be careful with your time. May have to have you come back again. But in terms of the income levels that are utilized to calculate utilization of this housing, how often are those income levels adjusted based on what the current economic situation is and inflation? Because I know that if those stay the same, people have to get to almost nothing. You know, I mean, the income level can be so low, and people who really are in poverty can't access the programs because there's really no recognition of the need to change the income level with the current economy. So how often is this income level reviewed and considered for change?
Senator Sharon, we use generally the federal definitions of income, and those are changed on an annual basis. One of the difficulties of some of the federal programs is, depending on which program it is, we're sometimes required to use the county median income as our benchmark. And as many of you know, certainly from greater Minnesota, there can be radical differences from one county to the next. And some counties that have maybe only one commercial center can end up with very, very low median incomes. And that can sometimes be challenging when we're required to not go higher than 60% of median income. I know we had this discussion just about a month ago down in a neighboring community down in Worthington. And certain reasons, that county has a very low median income. Other programs, we're actually able to use the statewide median income, and that evens things out a little bit, makes it a little bit easier. Moving on to slide number 17, some of the performance measures that you'll see us using here, we try to be very careful about locating projects that look like they're going to be in a community that really is growing and needs that support and can support that housing for at least 30 years. And so a little over 83% of our rental developments are in those areas. We also are attentive to access to transit, not just in the Twin Cities, but also in greater Minnesota, where we have a definition of whether there is a bus service or dial-a-ride service, and also the access through walking distance to different services like doctors and banks and et cetera.
Commissioner Senator Hayden has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Tingenthal. Just to go back to the challenge just for a quick minute, I was trying to get in before we moved on. I know that there was, due to the economic downturn and foreclosures and all of those kind of things, there was some, I won't say reluctance, but there wasn't a usage of the challenge fund as much as there normally has. Has there been a change in that? Are we getting good applications? Are we using all the dollars that are allocated for the challenge fund?
Ms. Chair, Senator Hayden, it's an interesting question. We tend to think of the challenge fund as one of our most flexible resources. And so when we receive applications for a particular project, we try to use the various federal resources and local resources to put together the package that best fits each of those projects. One of the nice things that's happened in the last few years is that the price that investors are willing to pay for federal housing tax credits has been quite high, meaning more money into the project, and interest rates on loans that they might get from a bank or from us have been quite low. Mm-hmm. And so the actual gap that we've needed to fill with the Challenge Fund has maybe been a little smaller. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to stretch those dollars a bit further. That came about only after the market recovered with some tools that were provided through the 2009 Stimulus Act. There was about a year and a half there where things were a little bit slower, but I would say we had a very robust set of applications this past summer, and we were able to use all of the challenge dollars.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Moving on to slide number 18, getting to our fourth strategic priority, preventing and ending homelessness. This is a set of programs that I think the legislature and the agency really should be very proud of. This really came out of an effort back in 2004 to adopt a statewide business plan to end long-term homelessness. And I'm very pleased to say it is definitely one of the most innovative and well-coordinated programs in the entire country. We work very closely with the Department of Human Services, the Department of Corrections, Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Health, Department of Public Safety, and DEED in delivering programs that really try to get at families and households that have experienced homelessness over the long term and getting them into permanent supportive housing so that they are not utilizing or overutilizing shelters. If I could have you turn just for 1 second to slide number 19. Homelessness is something that we're often asked about because you keep hearing, well, the numbers are worse. What we've shown you here is that, yes, during the economic downturn, the numbers actually went up from 2005 up to 2010 as a lot of people experienced loss of jobs. But one thing that we really are very proud of is that the number at the bottom, the green line, those that are chronically homeless, really has gone down over that period of time. Not as much as we would like, but we think that this is an indicator that by focusing on finding people who have been in and out of shelters, getting them into permanent supportive housing really is a solution that is both cost-effective and much more effective for the families themselves. There are really three programs that you'll see in our budget that are state-appropriated programs. The Family Homeless Prevention Program, Homeless and Assistance Program, is exactly what it says. These are dollar amounts that usually go out in the size of somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000 to families that, but for some short-term financial assistance, would be likely to show up in a shelter. And so they're used for things like a damage deposit or first month's rent deposit for an affordable rental property or even a market rate rental property to prevent them from becoming homeless. These are administered by social service agencies throughout the state. The Bridges program is a longstanding program, I think a very courageous effort on the part of this state to provide rental assistance for those that are suffering from mental illness, and has helped us in really complying with some of the requirements to deinstitutionalize those with mental illness. And finally, the Housing Trust Fund. This is a program that can be used either for bricks and mortar, for building new properties, or for rental assistance. And at this point, I have to say that we anticipate that 100% of the request in the Housing Trust Fund would be for continuing rental assistance for those properties that we have either that we have financed over the last 8 years. So we're not able at the current level of funding for the Housing Trust Fund to really generate any new supportive housing. We are simply maintaining the rental assistance on that housing that has already been financed in earlier years through the Housing Trust Fund. One of the things I mentioned is that in 2004, the state adopted a business plan to end long-term homelessness, and you have at your places a handout that is entitled Heading Home Minnesota, which is a nonprofit consortium of organizations that is focused on this goal. And the goal back in 2004 was to create 4,000 permanent supportive housing opportunities. And I'm very pleased to say that we believe that sometime during this next year that we will actually meet that goal of 4,000 units. So finally, you know, you have somebody in front of you saying, we set a goal and we're going to meet it. And what I would like to say is that I'm very excited that, in fact, today we have just filled a position, which is the statewide director on homelessness issues, whose job it will be to convene the commissioners of the agencies I mentioned earlier, all of which touch homelessness, and really develop sort of the next chapter of the business plan to end homelessness. Her name is Kathy Tenbrook, and she's well known to many people, particularly in Hennepin County, for her efforts over the years in working on the goal of ending homelessness. So we're very excited about that. It's going to continue to be a very tough job, but I think we've got a lot of the right pieces in place to make that happen. Turning now to page 20.
Chair?
Madam Chair? Senator Rosen, and then may I say before you ask your question that it's coming up on 1 o'clock, so I just want you to try to focus on your priorities here. Senator Rosen.
I'm sorry. Well, I did have a question about the regional plans and the counties on this Heading Home program, and you're not quite up to the number of counties that we have in the state. Are you going to be filling in the gaps of those counties? There, you've got, what, 75?
Senator Rosen, I know that the continuums of care, as they are called, that put these plans together is a voluntary sort of operation, and so there are some counties that have chosen not to participate.
Oh.
All right. Let us go then with the idea of focus to page 21, preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery. I know that there is a lot of continuing concern about foreclosures, and did want to show you what you have undoubtedly read in the paper, that it does appear very clearly in Minnesota that that we have turned the corner. And on slide number 22, you can see that the sheriff sales are going down in all locations around the state. That doesn't mean that there aren't communities that are still suffering from vacant and boarded houses, and we work very closely through our programs for this area to work with communities to address those issues. Some of the challenge dollars can also be used for this reason. Wrapping up then on page 24, we do still believe that the construction industry is one that's been very hard hit, and that there is a nice convergence between the fact that construction jobs are very important to the recovery of the economy, and the fact that we actually have places around the state that have a shortage of housing. So we think as you consider your investments, that investments in housing make a lot of sense. On page 25, I think some of you may be aware that the governor's office has worked on developing a set of sort of dashboard indicators And two of those indicators really revolve around housing. And the one is the one indicator is what percentage of households spend more than 30% of their income on housing. And as I mentioned earlier, that's 33%. And that has warranted a yellow light, kind of a caution light, in terms of we think that that could be better. And also an indicator is that 7,500 Minnesotans are homeless on any given day. And again, that warrants a yellow light on the state dashboard. So with those two focuses, if you look at the arrows above, we really focus at Minnesota Housing on two big themes: increasing housing affordability and ending homelessness. So you know, when we try to be bullet focused on where all of our programs are trying to have an impact, it is in those two areas. So in conclusion,
Commissioner Senator Hayden has a question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Tingenthal, before you conclude, I'd like to ask a question about foreclosures relative to the amount of foreclosures that we've had over the last 4 years, 5 years. Has your model on home ownership changed, or can you give me your thoughts of if your model of home ownership has changed or needs to change to deal with the aftermath of when one goes into foreclosure?
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, we have done a number of things at various parts of the spectrum. First of all, I would say that overall, the mortgage lending industry has become more conservative in the way that we underwrite. We want to make sure that borrowers have sufficient dollars to pay those mortgages every month. It has been primarily reflected, I would say, in credit scores, but also looking at kind of the amount available for other uses during the month. So just in the core underwriting of our loans, I would say we've been a little more conservative, not probably as conservative as the conventional market, but want to make sure we're not getting homeowners in over their heads. On another part of the spectrum, we have been working with a number of organizations to provide alternative financing. We've worked, for example, with the Greater Metropolitan Housing Corporation on an alternative financing mechanism that works a little bit like a lease purchase program to help borrowers who are maybe didn't have a job, suffered a foreclosure. Now they have a job, their lives are stabilized again, but because of the foreclosure, they'll have to wait another 4 or 5 years before they can get a conventional mortgage. And we've provided some alternative financing for them as well. We also work with numerous programs around the state for home buyer counseling and making sure that people know what they are getting into, including the development together with the U.S. Department of Agriculture on a online homebuyer counseling course that is now available throughout the state.
Then, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Hayden.
Just one follow-up question. So there was a report not long ago in the Star and Tribune and maybe other papers that talked a lot about folks that were getting themselves in trouble due to contract for deed. I think you kind of anticipated what I was going to ask. So can you talk a little bit about what your department has done or even your thoughts on how we can get a handle of people being exploited through these contract for deed situations that often they get into a contract for deed because that's the only way that they would be able to have a place to live?
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I wish I knew the answer to that question. We have, as I've said, tried to reach out through the various community organizations, community land trusts, Greater Metropolitan Housing Corporations, to make sure that that potential home buyers know that these alternative resources are available so that they don't succumb to the tempting offers of these unscrupulous contract for deed lenders. But it is a tough it's a tough situation, mm-hmm. and sometimes you just don't get to the people who need to hear the message.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're short on time, so I'll just be rather brief. But can you describe, Commissioner, a little bit, how does the need address the amount of need and your resources, either in terms of dollars or more specifically, I'm thinking about in terms of staffing. What type of wait period do people have who might contact your office or agency? Are they getting the help that they need right away? Are they getting connected? Are they getting hung up in phone tag? So kind of describe that process to me and how long someone might have to wait before they get assistance.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I would say that the answer to that question varies widely depending on the type of assistance that they are requesting. So, for example, our rehabilitation loan program, which is a very low-income program for homeowners to do very basic repairs, the waiting list for that can be very long, and we frequently run out of money halfway into the year, because those families are so low income, even though they own a house, they're so low income that we have to essentially do it in the form of a deferred loan, almost a grant. And so the dollars for that are scarce. Historically, about $5.5 million a year, but there are, hundreds of thousands of low-income homeowners around the state, especially elderly. I would say also with the Family Homeless Prevention Program, there we're probably a little better at a quicker turnaround because it is designed to be an emergency program, and so the dollars are geared. But sometimes in that program, we also run out of resources. On the other hand, our mortgage program, where we're utilizing tax-exempt bonds and the capital markets, where it's not as scarce a resource, those dollars are typically available through the normal processing turnaround times through our lenders. What we really try to do is not utilize not have people apply through Minnesota Housing when they are individual homeowners or home buyers. The only funds that have to be applied for on a competitive basis are really our multifamily development funds that come directly to the agency.
One quick follow-up.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Specifically, I guess I was looking more at the rental assistance because that's so important, people who absolutely need a spot. What's the need and resources like on the rental assistance piece?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, it really varies around the state, but generally either Section 8 buildings or public housing buildings generally have very long waiting lists. And, for example, in St. Paul, I know that they have not reopened their waiting list in at least 2 years. I think it's even longer in Minneapolis. So there is definitely, when it comes to affordable rental properties, definitely a continuing scarcity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Are you coming to conclusion?
I am. All right. So very, very quickly, things I'd like you to remember about us. We're good at leveraging dollars, both private and public resources. Virtually every program that we administer leverages other resources. We generally use the private sector to develop and deliver those resources. Investments in housing create and retain jobs in the construction sector. We make investments in every community around the state, and we try to be somewhat targeted so that it's not one size fits all, and take a lot of input from local communities to make sure that they're getting the assistance in the form that works best in those regions. And finally, to remind you that 100% of any appropriations that come to the agency go directly to serving low and moderate income Minnesotans.
Are there any final questions? Well, thank you very much, Commissioner, for coming and presenting here today. Our next presentation will be from the Department of Health. Commissioner Ellinger is here to present. And as he's coming to the table, I would just like the committee to know that I think it's important for me to disclose as the chair of the committee that my family's business is in this field of affordable housing, in part. We have a variety of responsibilities for managing housing and developing housing, and some of the housing that we have developed has taken advantage of some of these programs, and we do manage properties that address the needs of low-income persons as a part of our portfolio. So although I have been engaged in discussions about what and if there's going to be conflicts of interest for me, so far it doesn't appear that there will be, but I wanted the committee to be aware of that and to know that we have quite a large portfolio of properties all through southern Minnesota and Iowa that are impacted by some of these policies that are established by the board. Welcome, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, appreciate this opportunity to come and talk with you about and give you an overview of the Minnesota Department of Health. We will be working together over the next several months in this session over the next couple of years on a whole variety of public health issues. So to sort of set the stage, I'd like to introduce myself to you so you know who you'll be working with and get a sense of where we're coming from. I've been in healthcare for over 40 years, and in fact, last year I celebrated the 40th anniversary from the graduation of medical school. And as I look back on the years that I've spent in medical care, I realize that every single year since graduation from medical school, there's been talk about health reform. We had to improve access. We had to improve lower cost, improve quality. And as I look back over those 40 years, I realize we haven't made a whole lot of progress in that, and certainly not in terms of reducing costs. When I graduated from medical school, the total GDP that went into healthcare was about 6%. Now it's up to 18%. And as I look back over my clinical practice, I'm board certified in internal medicine, which takes care of adults, and board certified in pediatrics, which takes care of kids, and I've practiced in urban communities and rural communities, I realized very quickly that I could see patients all day long, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, could never really have a huge impact on the health of the community by seeing patient after patient. Certainly could impact the health of individuals, but could I change the curve, bend the curve in terms of health and in terms of cost in the community? And I realized very quickly in my clinical practice that there were some other forces outside of that individual and that doctor-patient relationship that were really influential in looking at health. And so from that perspective, in my career, I've really been trying to integrate medical care and public health as a way to deal with health reform, as a way to deal with improving health in our communities, and as a way to improve individual health. And I've been able to do that in a variety of settings, as I said, in urban and rural communities, in several states, but mostly in the last 33 years in Minnesota. And in the process, I've been the president of the Twin Cities Medical Society and the president of the Minnesota Public Health Association, so really come with background in medical care and public health. And I've also put together a team of folks who are working with me to really advance this whole agenda of how to integrate medical care and public health, how to really focus on the health of the community. And I have my staff here with me. I got Aggie Lighthizer, who's the assistant commissioner in our Health Protection Bureau, Jean Ayers, who's the assistant commissioner in our Health Improvement Bureau, Lee Ho, who is our assistant commissioner in our administrative area. Ellen Benavides is ill today, and she's the assistant commissioner in our Bureau of Policy, Quality, and Compliance. Manny Munson-Regala, who is an assistant to the commissioner, really working on health reform issues. And Jim Koppel, who's the deputy commissioner of health. So they're here if you have any questions that I can't answer. But certainly they're here to work with you over the course of the session and over the next couple of years on any issues that you have. We're here to help you get you information as best we can. And I know you have slides on your table, and I also have some slides here in PowerPoint that we'll follow along. And I've got a lot of information. The Minnesota Department of Health is a large organization that has input in a whole variety of areas. So I'm going to go through things fairly quickly, and knowing that we'll be coming back and talking about some of those. But I just wanted to kind of highlight what we do in broad brush terms from a fairly high level, but then set the stage for further discussions as we go ahead. And certainly we have to start with our mission, to protect and maintain and improve the health of all Minnesotans. And that's one of the things that the Department of Health really focuses on, all Minnesotans. Whether you're on public programs, whether you're rich, whether you're poor, whether you're urban, whether you're rural, whether you're suburban, whether you're old, whether you're young, all Minnesotans. And we really focus a lot on all Minnesotans to make sure that everybody benefits from the state of Minnesota and our health system and our quality of life here. All Minnesotans, really focusing a lot on reducing disparities, because that is one of the things that I've noted since being in Minnesota, that even though on the average we're doing very well as a state, we have some of the greatest disparities in both in racial and ethnic disparities, but also geographic disparities, and certainly in economic disparities. If you look at infant mortality, if you look at longevity, if you look at teen pregnancy, all of those issues have some huge disparities that are sometimes hidden by the overall status of health in Minnesota. So I want to make sure that we highlight those as one of the things that the department does. And as a little bit of history, particularly since the fact that last year, 2012, was the 140th birthday of the Minnesota Department of Health. The legislature authorized towns and cities first to look at public health and do the regulation, and really focused a lot on local public health for the first several years of statehood. And then in 1872, Minnesota became the fourth state to really develop a board of health. Charles Hewitt was the first secretary, and it was just last week that I understand that a street in Red Wing is now named after Charles Hewitt, who really started the Minnesota Department of Health. And I think that one of the statements that Dr. Hewitt made back then in 1872, I think is still relevant to today, and particularly the approach we take at the Minnesota Department of Health. He said, "Prevention first, cure if you must, capacity to do in both directions." And I think that is what really our focus is, that prevention is the best strategy, but certainly we want to have the best curative and care system we have, but we need to do both in both directions. Minnesota was served by a Board of Health until 1977, when the State Board of Health was abolished and the Minnesota Department of Health was established as a department within the state government. And the duties of the secretary were transferred to the commissioner. And at the same time, the local Community Health Services Act was passed, establishing community health service agencies in counties throughout the state. And we've had that structure since that time, with a commissioner of health, local public health, working collaboratively to really advance the health of the state of Minnesota. Now, I put this slide on, which really just highlights the fact that the Minnesota Department of Health uses the media to get out messages. One of our jobs is to educate the community about what's going on, but also we're the trusted source of health information. The expertise within the department, a whole variety of areas, is really dependent upon by the citizens of the state and certainly by the media to get information. So you'll be hearing all sorts of things in the media about things that the Minnesota Department of Health works on a day-to-day basis. Certainly just in the last week, all of the issues about influenza. Certainly over the last couple of months, the issues of whooping cough or pertussis, norovirus, all sorts of things like that, infectious diseases, diseases related to diabetes and heart disease, homelessness and housing, which are a real public health issue, are visible in the media because of a lot of the work that we do, and we're the trusted source for that information. Now, in the next several sets of slides, I'm going to be very brief, because I have a feeling, though, that you may hear about some of these things, but you may not recognize where the issues are dealt with in state government. So I'm going to go through very briefly the the issues that you may be seeing about in fact that these are things that the Minnesota Department of Health is focusing on a day-to-day basis. Now, this Minnesota Department of Health houses the office of the state registrar, so we issue birth certificates and death certificates. We issue over 750,000 of them every year, birth and death records. We also work with the funeral industry to make sure that people are buried properly and it is a safe way to protect our environment. And there are, with an average of 104 deaths per day, our mortuary science business is fairly aggressive. It's fairly busy. Also, the things that you may see most often in the media are things related to our around-the-clock monitoring for infectious diseases. I must do a little bit of bragging, but I do think that we probably have the best epidemiological unit, the unit that goes out and investigates disease, monitors disease, follows up on it in the country. And as I go around the country talking with my colleagues in other states, they say, you're really fortunate to work with the Minnesota Department of Health and that epidemiology team, which is known worldwide for its expertise. Our public health laboratory and our epidemiologists really work around the clock to monitor infectious diseases. We've identified some new outbreaks. Certainly the progressive inflammatory neuropathy, the brain injury, the disease that was found in workers working with swine because of the method they were using to work on the brains and get those out of the swine, caused a disease that hadn't been known before. And our work with our partners at CDC and U.S. Department of Agriculture identified this and changed the practice throughout the country and how workers worked with swine. With the information that we have, we also are swift and effective in dealing with issues. A couple of years ago in Slayton, they had an outbreak of hepatitis A, and we were able to go into Slayton with immunizations, immunoglobulin, to help with that outbreak. So we identify, we monitor, we interact, and we respond. We also do a lot of work with the food and water that all of us eat. And this is the fact that, you know, everybody in the state is affected by the work of the department. We do a lot of work in the environmental health area. And it's probably a place where it should identify the fact that the PCA, or the Pollution Control Agency, deals with the environment, but looks at it more as what harm are people doing to the environment. Our job with our environmental health program flips that around, and we say, how does the environment affect the health of people? And so that's why we really focus a lot on food, on water, on air quality, what goes on in people's homes. Those are the kinds of activities that we focus on with our epidemiology or our environmental health program. And then one of the things that you may be interested in that the Minnesota Department of Health oversees the abandoned wells, and we seal more abandoned wells than all other states combined. So we have a fairly aggressive sense. Water is so crucial to this state that we really take that as one of our serious challenges. Also related to that, advice about risks. A lot of the flooding and tornadoes puts our environment at risk for health, and so we respond to those. Certainly recently up in Duluth where we had the flood, we were there checking the wells, checking the behavioral health issues, checking the emergency response and how to reduce problems, particularly related to mold, is one of the current things that we're working on. Also, over the last several years, the last 10 years in particular, we've really been focusing on statewide preparedness for responding to public health emergencies. Most recently, it was the pandemic of 2009, H1N1. But what we have learned from the work over the last 10 years is being used today as we respond to the influenza outbreak in the state. We have the policies and the procedures and the relationships and the partnerships in place to deal with that. And that is one of the things that I've discovered since becoming Commissioner of Health is that the planning that has been done over the last 10 years since 9/11 with a lot of federal funds has really been beneficial to us in a whole variety of situations related to pandemics, related to flu, related to disasters and various floods throughout the state. But I'm also concerned that as I see the reduction in federal funds that is coming in this area, that unless we continue to work on these disaster preparedness, emergency preparedness, the capabilities are going to decline, because they don't just, once you do the training, once you do the setting the systems in place, they need some maintenance. So we need to continue to focus on how to keep those up to date and current. Other things that we do with the Minnesota Department of Health is a place where you get immunization, where you get a lot of information about immunizations, where you get recommendations on immunizations. This slide just shows where we were influential in getting pneumococcal vaccine as a routine practice, and you see that the number of cases of pneumococcal disease and infection, which really was killing lots of babies, really went down dramatically. And as a pediatrician, seeing the benefit of really implementing this immunization program was tremendous. It saved families lots of stress and problems. We also do things like the WIC program, where we provide food vouchers to over 145,000 mothers and children throughout Minnesota. And it links to a lot of other programs related to healthy pregnancies, early child development, working on improving birth outcomes. It's also, Minnesota Department of Health is also a place where you make sure that access to care for our rural Minnesotans in particular, because of the geographic distances, where we really focus a lot on providers in rural communities, but also on the statewide trauma system, which really makes sure that if something happens in rural communities, that there is emergency medical services available. And it's often overlooked as a public health issue that we really need to focus on. And also we focus on making sure that people in hospitals and nursing homes and healthcare facilities are really safe, and if there are problems, that we address that. Over 687,000 Minnesotans receive care at some time during the year in a nursing home or hospital. So it's really affecting most of Minnesotans. Another area that we focus on in MDH is all of the information we get related to health insurance or total health care spending or healthcare capacity and utilization, what adverse events are occurring in hospitals, what is happening with safety net providers throughout the state. Our health policy, health economics unit really looks at all of the medical care pieces and access to it, because even though we don't deliver medical services, we really oversee the medical services to make sure that people have access to them, that they're affordable, and that they're of high quality. And all of our work in this area is really helpful in our discussions on health reform.
And Madam Chair.
And our focus on health reform is really...
Excuse me, Commissioner, would you take a question now?
Sure, please.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, this chart goes to 2009. When do you foresee getting updated numbers?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we provide that information every spring. This slide, we just didn't update this in time. We do have 2010, 2011 data.
Okay.
That we can get to you.
Is that available on your website?
Yes. Okay. And we can also get this specific chart updated to you.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
And you've probably heard of the triple aim of health reform, improve population health, reducing costs, and improving the patient experience. We have a major role to play, because we're the place, MDH is the place that really looks at overall improvement in population health. We monitor those. We see what kind of things are needed to improve overall population health, whereas the clinical side really focuses on how do you provide care to an individual patient. We want to make sure that care to the individual patient is within the context of a broader way of really addressing all of the health issues that face our society. We also look at the value with the data that we collect. We make sure that we're doing primary care in the proper way, that we're coordinating care, that there are data that can incentivize quality payments as opposed to just paying for volume. The data that we have, as Senator Benson is referencing here, that this chart really tries to be as transparent as we can with the information about what's going on. One of the activities that we have with health reform that started in 2008 with a bipartisan approach to health reform was the Statewide Health Improvement Program, recognizing that obesity and diabetes, tobacco use, were contributing about 75% of total costs to our healthcare, the problems of our healthcare system, and that we needed a new way to address that. So the SHIP program, the Statewide Health Improvement Program, using best practices, developed a statewide approach to tobacco, reducing tobacco use and obesity, really focusing on policy systems and environmental change. And that was a statewide program. We've had to scale that back now to 51 counties with the budget reduction that we've had in the during this current biennium. But we're hoping that we can get back to a statewide approach to our statewide health improvement program, because this has gives us the best potential to actually achieving the triple aim of reducing costs and improving population health, because we're not going to be able to treat our way into good health. We're going mm-hmm. To have, as I said, the combination of treatment and prevention. And MDH is also a place where you get lots of information. This slide and the next just basically show that we put out a lot of information about diseases like diabetes and heart disease and issues related to tobacco and alcohol and physical inactivity and poor nutrition. Through various venues, as I said, through the media, but at state fairs, community meetings throughout the state, my going around with Pitch the Commissioners is trying to educate folks about how important addressing these issues are. And these are just examples of some of the things. The Cover Your Cough, certainly a reminder to all of you to, if you haven't already, get your flu shot. And if you do start to cough, into your sleeve, please. That's as the state doctor, I have to acknowledge that. And as I mentioned, when we're talking about the mission of the Minnesota Department of Health for all Minnesotans, I want to again highlight the fact that there are many Minnesotans who do not benefit from all of the benefits of the state, and particularly groups in racial and ethnic minorities, some geographic disparities that we really need. If we're going to be a healthy state overall, we have to eliminate those disparities. So we have an Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. We have a grant program that focuses on disparities called the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, and I'm sure you'll be hearing more about that as we move forward. So that's a rapid-fire thing of some of the things that we do. Now I want to take that and then put it into the context of how we see our work being done and why we take the approaches that we have. And this is the org chart, and you've got the org chart in front of you, I think, in a larger thing. And it looks pretty complex, and you know, all of these distinguished folks behind me are responsible for managing some of those areas. But really, public health is really not that complicated. It really comes down to basically three things that the Minnesota Department of Health does. We focus on health protection, we focus on health improvement, and we focus on improving the healthcare system around a public health framework. That's basically the three things that we do. You know, the health protection, how to keep people healthy, the vaccinations, the control of infectious diseases, the safe food, the safe water. Those are the things that we do to protect people. The health improvement piece, trying to get people to adopt healthy lifestyles, to reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke, making sure that food is available, to get people to prevent people from starting to smoke and getting them to quit if they've started. And then the third piece, which I'll get into a little bit more later, is how our healthcare system, where most of the resources go, needs to be re-looked at to make sure that we make the best investment of the scarce dollars that we have in our healthcare system. So I want to spend just a little bit of time getting the context of how we see health and healthcare and public health in the state. Now, most people, when they think about health and healthcare, they think of this system where we have two parallel systems. One is the medical care system, and one is the public health system. And that's how we fund things, and that's how we organize a lot. But our view is that we really need to change the paradigm of how we do that. And we really, really need to look at the fact that the health of the public should be at the top. And our public health system really needs to take into account all aspects of the things that influence health. And there are certainly some things in the health or healthcare system, but then there are many other influences. That's why I was pleased to be following my colleague from housing, which is one of those other influences that really impacts health. If we could have everybody in the state have secure, stable, safe housing, we would eliminate many of our public health problems. We'd eliminate many of our education problems if we just had that stable, safe, and healthy living environments. So we have the same thing with transportation. Transportation is a huge impactor on health. The educational system impacts health. And so that partnership that we have to see, they have to be part of the public health system in our state. On the health system side itself, we have the medical care piece. Then we have the prevention services that occur in that clinical setting, the clinical prevention services, you know, giving the immunizations, taking the blood pressure, doing the mammograms. And then we have the community or population-based health services, all of the environmental health activities that we do, the home visiting that we do with communities, the policies that relate to tobacco use, the policies that relate to housing, all of those public health policies that influence the entire population. So that is the environment that we see the Minnesota Department of Health playing as one, as a player within the health system, but also as a coordinator of all of the issues that work in making this a healthy state. We don't own all of those issues. We don't have control over all of those issues, but it is our role to get people to the table. It is our role to convene. It's our role to stimulate that discussion that where we really see everybody coming together to create a healthy environment. And we come at this because if you look at the factors that contribute to premature death, you can see that healthcare really is only about 10% of that whole pie. Behavioral patterns, genetics, social circumstances, environmental exposures really make up 90% of what influences our health. We know that. The data show that. And our experience proves that out. But we measure things in different ways. These are the leading causes of death. If you look at the death certificate, they say, what's the cause of death? And if you look at those, you know, leading cause of death is heart disease, cancer, stroke. So that's how we think about death. But when you look at what's behind that, the real causes of death, it's really not heart disease, cancer, and stroke. It's tobacco use, poor diet, inactivity, alcohol use, infectious diseases, toxic agents, firearms, sexual abuse. These are the things that actually cause the heart disease, cancer, and stroke that get on the death certificate. But yet we really fund the things related to the treatment of heart disease, cancer, and stroke. This slide shows that on the left shows those factors, the real causes of death or the contributors to a premature death, and on the right shows where our dollars go. Whereas access to care, medical care, really accounts for only about 10% of the influence on premature death, it gets 88% of the dollars. All of the other 90% gets less than, you know, 15% of the total dollar. So I think this is one of the things that we will be arguing that we need to balance.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen? Is it Senator Rosen?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, on these causes of death, do you have a further breakdown as how much it's costing the state for tobacco or illicit use of drugs? Just have a percentage of what it is.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we do have estimates on the impact that tobacco causes, the impact that alcohol causes. We haven't done the economic analysis on every one of those, but we certainly do on the top two. For example, alcohol, it costs the state of Minnesota about $5.9 billion a year from all of the problems that are caused by alcohol. In particular, that's remarkable in the fact that the tax that we have on alcohol only brings in about $200 million. So there's a big discrepancy in what alcohol causes in our state from what it brings in taxes. Similarly, with tobacco, it causes about $3 billion worth of costs in our state. So those are big economic issues in addition to health issues.
Commissioner, when I look at this graph about where our expenditures are in relationship to medical care versus programming that addresses these contributing factors to the problems, the heart disease or cancer, and you're pointing out to us that you'd like to see a different balance of where expenditures are going. And you may not be able to answer this, but I'm thinking, is it possible for us to increase our commitment of dollars to these programs that address tobacco, diet, alcohol, or other kinds of behavioral changes that have to occur? Is that expenditure less expensive so that the overall percentage doesn't have to be equivalent, 50-50 expenditure on medical care versus prevention programs, because you can do in the side of prevention much more with less dollars? Is that a truth? Is that a fact?
Yep. Madam Chair, as I look around the country and as the Institute of Medicine, looked around the world, and as the Institute of Medicine recently did with a report that they put out last summer, looking at total spending of health and human services from country to country, where they looked at what's being spent for medical care, public health, and social services that impacts health, the United States is not at the top of the list. It's sort of far, down about 25% from the top. The difference between what the United States does and other countries is we spend over 50% of our total health and human services spending on medical care. Only two other countries in the world do that, and that's Mexico and Korea. Most other countries spend only about a third, 20% to a third of their total health and human services, which is medical care, public health, and social service, on the medical side. So I believe that we could continue to have the same investment in overall health, but if we rebalanced it, we would get bigger bang for our buck, because we're seeing that the things that really influence health, the determinants of health, are the public health and some of the social services that actually keep people healthy and keep them from having to use the very expensive medical care piece. My belief is that we need to have the best medical care system in the world, and we need fewer and fewer people to really use it.
You continue.
And I put this one in just as a colorful reminder of where our dollars go. This is from 1960 to the mid-2000s. Total expenditures of that $2.5 trillion that we spend in health care every year. The blue thing on the bottom is hospital care, the percent that goes into hospital care. The red is into physician services. The salmon is in prescription drugs. And way up there in the top, in whatever that aqua color, is the investment in public health. And this has been pretty stable. We've not been increasing our investment in public health. We need, if we're going to bend the cost curve, if we're really going to improve health, we are going to have to increase that investment in that public health activity. And a good example of how this works is this is a chart that shows longevity, how long people have lived, life expectancy, over the course of the last 100 years. And we've gained about 30 years of life over the last 100 years. 25 of those 30 years have really been because of prevention activities, because of public health activities, because of immunizations, because of improving clean water, improving the milk supply, improving food. That is the cause of what's going on. In the first 50 years, you can see the jagged line, and you have to point out the drop back in 1918 where our longevity plummeted. That was the influenza pandemic that really shortened people's lives dramatically. And then you'll also notice that right around 1950 or so, between 1950 or 60, our rate of improvement started to slow in terms of longevity. That's because the things that were really causing problems in our society, because of the prevention activities that we had, we were able to control a lot of acute infectious diseases, a lot of foodborne outbreaks, a lot of waterborne diseases, so that what was really starting to be problematic for folks were diseases like heart disease and diabetes and chronic lung disease. And at that point in time, because this is when I got into the medical field in the late 60s, early 70s, we took a treatment approach We took a specialization approach to dealing with those chronic diseases, with the heart disease and with cancer, and we stopped investing in the prevention focus. Prior to that, you know, like polio, we were able to deal with polio not by creating more iron lungs, but by having a polio vaccine. We're not going to be dealing with diabetes by developing the best kind of insulin. We're going to deal with diabetes by having a different kind of intervention, somewhat like the SHIP program, where it changes the systems, the policies, the environment that really supports people making healthy choices so that they don't become obese and don't become diabetics down the road. And so this is where we really need to relook at how we fund services and how we organize services, where we really do need to integrate the medical care in public health in ways that we've not done up until this point. I have two charts here that are a little complex, but they make the point. This chart, the red lines are the changes in deaths prevented. So you want the red line to be nice and high. And the blue line is costs, the change in costs. And so you want that blue line to be as low as possible. The three sets, and this is a 10-year, the first set of bars on the left is the 10-year perspective, and then on the right is the 25-year perspective. And it points out the first two sets of bars are related. If you just had medical care by itself, the second two sets of bars, if you did just prevention within a clinical setting, and the third set of bars are if you just did the public health activities. And you can see, looking at the 25-year outlook, way on the far right, if you just did the public health activities, did nothing else with our healthcare system, you would save the most lives, and that's the only thing that would actually reduce cost. That's if you did complete access to medical, everybody had access to care, you know, you would save some lives, and it would cost a whole lot of money. If you did some prevention activities in there, you'd save a lot more lives. You'd still cost a lot of money, but it's only with doing the public health activities where you'd save the most lives and actually reduce costs. That's if you did them separately. This chart shows that what would happen to costs if you did all three, if you gave everybody access to care, you added the clinical prevention activities in the clinic setting, and you did the public health activities along with that. And that's what that green line shows. That, yes, certainly as you started to expand some of the activities, you'd have an increase in cost, but then your costs would start going down. The same thing can be shown with the deaths prevented. You'd have a tremendous impact. So we really need to find ways to be able to do all three of those, that we need to have universal access to care, the care needs to focus on prevention, and we need to adequately sustain and fund the community prevention, the public health services. So Minnesota has always ranked as one of the healthiest states in the nation. Our most recent one, we're number 5. But we used to be number 1. And I think we have this lofty ranking not because of what we're doing right now. We have this lofty ranking because of what our state did 20, 30, 40 years ago. They made investments in the public health system. They made investments in other things, in the education system, which is really linked to public health. They made investments that really are paying benefits now. And so as the state's doctor, I guess, as the public health commissioner, I have to look down the road to say, what are we going to leave for my kids, my grandkids, and my great-grandkids? How are we going to get costs under control? How are we going to really improve overall health? And the way we're going to do it is by having a balanced approach of high-quality medical care, but also a high-quality, well-funded public health system. And I think, and I know, that public health is one of the best systems in the nation up to this point because we have a good, strong partnership with the state health department and local public health throughout the state. We have a great public health system. And as I go around the state, as I said, with Pitch the Commissioners, seeing what's going on in the communities, people are really anxious to do the public health that's out there. Through the community health boards, their tribal directors, we cover the state. And that is, I think, one of the best examples in the state. And we really focus on health protection, health improvement. And I think because of all of the dollars that are going into the medical care side, we really need to look at health reform from a public health standpoint. And I think that's where in our public health system we need to really focus on the integration of that clinical care, the public health, and the social services collaboratively. Because as I look around the country, where it's not how it's financed, it's how it's integrated. I look around the globe, actually. The places that do the best job of keeping costs under control and having the best outcomes, they've been able to integrate public health, clinical care, and social services. They've been able to balance treatment and prevention, which we really have not done well in this state. And the best way to do that is, from the clinical side, reorienting our clinical care delivery around community-oriented primary care. Primary care is the place where you can actually do that integration. It's the place where you can actually do clinical prevention. It's actually the place where you can get communities engaged in creating their own health, the opportunities for health. As we focus on our community public health activities, our health reform discussions really are around community-oriented primary care and the integration of clinical public health and social services. Flu is a good example of that. Right now, this integration that we've been working on over the last 10 years related to pandemics has played out. When we've got an outbreak of influenza, that is one of the most severe ones we've had in quite a while. Over 1,000 hospitalizations, over nearly 500 hospitalizations just last week. 27 deaths, and that number is going to be rising. We've been able to partner with the treatment community to make sure that there is adequate access to emergency rooms and hospital beds. We've been able to make sure there's access to Tamiflu and influenza vaccines. And we've been able to work with our public health partners to make sure that people get educated, that they got notified of where and how to get their flu shots, and they've been notified about cover your cough and wash your hands and social distancing. It is one of the ways that the partnership really plays itself out. And so with all that, I'm not going to go into these in great detail, but just want to highlight for you the things that we're going to be working on during this session. Genetic privacy is one of those issues that is core to helping us do our work. We need to be able to collect the right information with the right protections to make sure that we can monitor diseases, monitor outbreaks, and respond in an effective fashion. And we're working to get the genetic privacy bill in a situation that will allow us to do that while still protecting patient rights and patient confidentiality. We'll be working.
Excuse me, Commissioner, Senator Benson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Last year we went through quite a process with the baby blood samples, DNA being collected. Could you just give us a brief update on where that is and how it relates to your genetic privacy priorities?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, the newborn screening program was the focus of a Supreme Court decision. And so when the Supreme Court ruled that what we were doing was not allowable, we had to change how we did the collection and use and dissemination and storage of blood spots. And so during the last session, we were able to craft a piece of legislation working with the legislature to make that happen. But as we look at that Supreme Court ruling, we recognize that it had implications beyond just newborn screening. It had implications for many of the other activities that go on in the department where we collect information, where we collect specimens. And many of those things, like collecting information about somebody with tuberculosis, that has an impact, could potentially have an impact on other people. We wanted to make sure that we had the ability to use that information in a public health format so that in a public health way so that we could continue to collect the information and use the information for intervention and for the public health good. So the newborn screening bill, I think that's going to stay, that activity is going to stay as it was fixed in the last session. And now we're going to try to make sure that we can continue to use the other data and our other programs for public health purposes.
Senator Benson.
Just a brief follow-up, Madam Chair and Commissioner. So will you be giving patients more opportunities to opt out or fewer? One of the challenges with the newborn screening was opt-in, opt-out, and you're talking about a patient with tuberculosis, obviously an adult who could make an informed choice. Which direction is the department moving?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, this is one of the problems with collecting data that has public health implications. And informed, we believe in informed consent, but there are times when somebody does not want to release information that it will have an impact on others. So that if a person does not want to, TB, for example, say, no, you can't report this information, that person could get on a plane and expose lots of other folks to tuberculosis. So we want to make sure that we have very specific of the kinds of things that where we can get information without consent, but use it in a way that protects the person's privacy as much as possible while maintaining the balance with protecting public health.
Okay, thank you. Senator Nino?
Thank you, Madam Chair. About four slides back, I had a question. It was to be the healthiest state Minnesota must invest in. And earlier you were talking about impacts of lifestyle and activities, and you mentioned, if I remember the numbers correctly, alcohol had an economic impact of $5.9 billion and tobacco, I think it was three. And on this slide, tobacco was highlighted, but not alcohol. I was just curious why, even though it had the smaller economic impact.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, it's not on this list because most of the activities related to alcohol are in the Department of Human Services. It's a public health issue, and it is someplace where I think the prevention activities that we do are really crucial in terms of improving health. But our investment has really been into early identification as a country, early identification and treatment as opposed to prevention. And I think you point out very wisely that we should probably put alcohol on this list because it is one of the leading causes of death and disability. And even though we don't have a large program because of the way funding goes, that we should be looking at that as something that is within our purview, which we do see it as within our purview.
Thank you. Are you coming close to
coming
conclusion?
Close, yes. Okay. Pushing the wrong button. Their statewide health improvement program, we really want that to go statewide. Our SHIP program, and we really want to make this a center point of our health reform because I think this is where we can save costs and improve health. Our health system reform, I have mentioned our focus that we're doing. We're working on healthy homes where a lot of work has done to deal with radon, with lead, with mold, with indoor air quality that will affect a lot of health. It'll reduce a lot of costs if we can improve that. And then we need, as I mentioned, we invested in a lot of things that have prevented diseases and illnesses from happening. We need to invest in those core public health activities to maintain what we've got. We've got a great public health system. We've got a great health department. And when I came in, I said one of my priorities is to maintain MDH as the premier public health agency, state public health agency in the country. We need investments in order to maintain that position. So with that, I want to just end with what public health is, according to the Institute of Medicine. It's public health, what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. That means we all partner. You're major players in our public health system. The policies that you put forward will impact the health of everybody in this state. My commissioners and other agencies are part of the public health team in transportation and housing and corrections, human services and education. They are part of the team. Communities throughout the state are major players in public health. The business community is part of public health. We need to work collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. It means having the right policies and the right systems and the right environment that supports health, that helps individuals make the healthy choices. and make those choices an easy choice to make. So that's what we'll be working on over this year, and I look forward to partnering with you on these efforts. And I'm open to any questions, and my team is here to respond to anything that I can't answer.
Are there any immediate questions? I know we'll have opportunity to ask questions more as proposals come forward. So seeing none, I thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your being here. I thought the presentation was really very interesting, and also Commissioner Tingerthal. I had joked to the members of our committee beforehand that I was going to ask both the commissioners to present their information in a musical form in order to bring some spice to it. But I think it really has been presented in an interesting way, and obviously we've been very attentive, so I appreciate
you
being
here. Madam Chair, I do carry a kazoo with me at all times, so if you ever do need some help, right. I do have a kazoo available.
Thank you. Before we retreat today, I'd like to do a couple of things. First, I want to draw your attention to some information that will be in your folder. This has been requested at various meetings I've had with members of the committee, in which you're given data about what affordability, what income levels are in order to be eligible for programs. We're going to try to design a little briefer cheat sheet on what the acronyms are for Health and Human Services and housing. I know that the committee administrator has sent out a very long form to you that you can print out if you want to, with all of the various acronyms that are on there. But we'll try to do one that is most commonly used in the committee. So we will try to gather for you information as you need it for your folder. And Chelsea will be available and would love to hear from you if there's something specifically that you think the committee-wide would like to have to help orient us when we're looking at these bills. I wanted to let you know that there is a meet and greet with the Department of Health and Human Services staff tomorrow at 11:30 to 12:30 in room 400. So key staff members will be available, and they're inviting all of us to come by and to be able to meet the various players in the department tomorrow if you're free. They really would like to reacquaint themselves with each of us. The handouts are in the folder, and I thought then as the last thing today, although I'm sure many of you know the players at the front table, but I thought at least we would go and make introductions as to who the staff members are that are going to be with us during the next year. So I'd like to begin with Sarah.
I'm Sarah Page, and I am Senator Sharon's legislative assistant.
I'm Chelsea Magadans, the committee administrator.
I'm Joan White, Senate counsel.
Madam Chair and members, Dave Lebeko, analyst. I do long-term care issues.
Great. So with that, unless there's anything further, recess. Adjourned, right?
For adjourned. I was going to say, how long is that?
Yeah. 11:30 to 12:30.
Yeah. 11:30 to 12:30. 400 North.